I also notice there are several flaws in the findings to support approval, and the emergency ordinance recommends that the commentary in Exhibit A, Planning Commission's reports and recommendations to the TOD tax exemption request for the Alberta mixed-use apartments be accepted as legislative intent as findings. However, the PC report is dated June 12th, prior to the city receiving multiple land use appeals, and recommends approval for the land use decision with modifications to the rear setback, similar to the first speaker we had today. And more of that's in the email. I won't go into all these details, just so other people have a chance to speak.
Excellent. And if
I can submit this for the record to the recorder if you'd like me to.
That'd be great.
Hi. My name is Tracy Olson. I think you guys went over a lot of my concerns, but I would like to address one that you raised, and that was breaking the chain of financial information that's presented, because it's very concerning. I think everybody knows that if you want financials to look a certain way, you can certainly make them look whatever you want. And as lay people, we have no way to really analyze those numbers to determine whether or not they're accurate or not. So in justifying a tax abatement of this magnitude, I think it would be important that there is some kind of this magnitude in this climate, you know, not necessarily that this magnitude isn't worthy of our examination no matter what climate we're in. But in this climate especially, I think it's important that there's some kind of legitimate, objective analysis of the financial information by experts who aren't associated with benefits from the project directly. Additionally, I was concerned about the LEED certification, which is different than LEED standard building. You know, you can build something to a standard, but it's different to go get the certification, and that has never been on the table as far as I know. And it is an objective standard in justifying the abatement. And lastly, which goes more to the project's character, there's extreme concern in the neighborhood about the lack of respect given to the neighbors and the community, the cultural significance of the area, which has been neglected with pattern over time. And the general consensus and attitude by neighbors is that nobody cares and that's the way it's just going to be. But we're here to tell you that we do, and that people have lived here their whole lives, you know, have built a significant and important history that's being completely ignored and steamrolled.
I'd like to say that I've lived in the area for 35 years.
I actually wanted to ask a question before you started. So, Tracy, I was intrigued by the comment. I frankly haven't read a lot about this project, and I was just relying on the financials I got here today, but the comment about not reflecting the character of the neighborhood and the cultural heritage, what does that exactly mean to you?
That goes to the design guidelines, and that also goes to the appeal, the project design appeal, which is in process. That this design overlay that's in this in this EX zone is supposed to mandate that their character of the neighborhood be reflected in some way in the development, and it's not. And the Architectural Heritage Center has written a letter in opposition to the development.
I guess I'm asking I'm trying to figure out what that means. It's not, is there certain pitches to the roof or the size of
there's
the windows or the color?
Yeah, there's design. I mean, there's transitions into the neighborhood. There's public amenities like open spaces. There's landscaping. Everything that they're trying to minimize are basically considerations to that effect. Because when something abuts a residential neighborhood, it is supposed to be compatible with the neighborhood, and especially when it's such drastic use change.
So if you wouldn't mind emailing me very specifically those very specific points so I can analyze those, that would be helpful.
Sir, you had something you wanted to add?
I just wanted to state that I don't believe any of us are opposed to development in that area. There's a lot of blight, if you will. There's a lot of property that's available for use, but what we'd like to have considered is the sensitivity of the people surrounding it. And a tax abatement seems to be a slap in the face to the citizens when we're laying off teachers and that developers are getting a 10-year tax abatement to the tune of something like $1 million. It just seems like it's not the right way to go for the tax abatement.
Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate it. Anybody else signed up?
Yes, we have two more people. Teresa Armington and Tosha Young.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Yeah. Good morning. Welcome to the City Council. We're glad you're here.
Thank you.
Just give us your first and last name, and you'll each have 3 minutes.
My name is Teresa Armington. I'm a resident of the neighborhood. In fact, I live directly behind where the proposed project is. I've lived there for 8 years. I've never been involved in this type of project before, so I don't have a lot of technical knowledge. I am concerned. This have the same concerns that have already been discussed here, but also the finances of the tax abatement. I am pro-construction in the area. I'm pro-commerce. I actually benefit from some of the commerce that has gone in on the Williams-Vancouver area, as well as that up and down MLK. And I appreciate how that's improved the life in the area and brought new life into the area, into our community. I feel concerned about a tax abatement for a large structure that's not going to match the character of our neighborhood, that is having so many amendments to processes and procedures that have been put in place specifically to help it blend into our neighborhood and to give them a chance to not pay into the community, to not pay taxes. Frustrating to me, especially in this economy, when we need more money coming into the community. We need more money coming into the city to support basic services. I'd like to see construction be able to add that into the community as well as adding local commerce.
Thank you for your comments. Hi.
Hi. My name's Tosha Young, and I also live in the neighborhood, just a couple houses down from Teresa. And I'm going to claim a lot of ignorance about city codes and tax abatements. I'm a second grade teacher who has managed to hold on to her job. So I'm, you know, speaking from just being a person that lives in the neighborhood. I think my main concern is the size of the project and the parking situation. I heard today that part of the reason why it was chosen to be located there is because it's close to mass transit. We don't have the infrastructure in our neighborhood to support just a mass transit population. The closest grocery store we have is New Seasons, and I am a double-income, no-child household, and we can't afford to shop at New Seasons every week. So I don't know if anybody has ever tried to do full-blown grocery shopping on the bus, but I'm pretty sure that it's not, you know, easy to do. So I think putting so many living units into a place that doesn't have the infrastructure, and then also, you know, not enough parking to support those units, I would, you know, implore you to take your time and consider this and consider the impact on the neighborhood. My husband and I moved to Oregon a few years ago and chose very carefully where we lived. And we chose this area, number one, because it was affordable for us, but also because of the diversity that's in the neighborhood, and we liked the feel of it, and we would hate to lose that.
Can I just, this is your first time testifying?
Yes.
You did a great job.
Your
disclaimer at the front end wasn't necessary, because I think you have a very good understanding of some of the issues. And I just want to set some expectations going forward, because this stuff gets very complicated. There's a whole land use process that is now underway, and that goes to the kind of building, the setbacks. There's some issues with design review, and those are all issues that maybe someday come to us, but that's premature. That's a separate process. Then we have a tax abatement process, and we have some rules governing when we will give someone that incentive. And the theory, and it's controversial, is that without it, in some cases, the things will not be built. And we use tax abatements as a tool, for example, to generate affordable housing, because it doesn't pencil out unless you give some incentive. Again, people have strong feelings about it, but I want to just be clear that what's before us now is to look at whether they qualify for an abatement. That's different than whether it's the appropriate building for the site. And I just want to say that issue will be dealt with over here. It may come to us. And on the abatement question, I'll take a referral on this and make sure that the concerns that relate to the abatement are heard and addressed at our next hearing. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Very well done. All right. So unless there are objections, this is referred to Commissioner Fish's office, and all future tax abatements will be run through his office before coming before the City Council for his review and his staff's review. We had considered this as part of the overall consolidation into the Bureau of Housing, but I guess there's some statutory hurdles in order to do that, so we'll do it virtually.
Thank you, Mayor.
So referred. Can you please read the title for Council Calendar Item, time certain at 10 p.m., 867?
Approve funding recommendations for early childhood, child abuse prevention intervention, foster care, after-school and mentoring programs made by the Children's Investment Fund Allocation Committee.
Good morning. Commissioner Saltzman.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor and members of the council. I am pleased to bring before you today a stimulus package, a $36 million over three-year investment package that not only invests in our children's future, but also invests in creating Head Start, early Head Start teaching positions, counselors, adult mentors, social workers, nurses, and a whole variety of what we would call our human infrastructure as opposed to our physical infrastructure. And we're doing this because the voters in 2002 created the Children's Investment Fund. And despite a tough economy, last November, Portlanders said they wanted to keep investing in our children to the tune of about $13 million per year. And that measure in November passed, despite the tough economy, with a 70% yes vote. So I'm very pleased to bring these investment recommendations to you today from the Allocation Committee, on which I serve, and you'll hear about that. One major change that the voters agreed to this time around was to add an additional investment category, and that is to invest in programs that will help children in foster care succeed. This is in addition to our existing investments of child abuse prevention and intervention in after-school and mentoring programs. So we went through a long, hard process. We had many, many more requests than we did have funds available, despite having $36 million. It seems like a lot, but not when you compare it to the requests we received. So we went through a hard process to finally bring these recommendations to you for funding. Children's Investment Fund Director Lisa Pellegrino will tell you more about that. Afterwards, Alyssa Kinney-Geyer, who is also on the Allocation Committee, will speak about the allocation process. And then finally, I'm happy to have Chantel Monk here to tell us about her experience in Big Brothers and Big Sisters programs, which is one of our programs we invest a lot of money in, and what that has done for her. So we'll turn it over to Lisa Pellegrino to start.
Good morning, commissioners. As Dan said, I'm Lisa Pellegrino. I direct the fund, and I'll give you just a brief overview of the process we went through to make the decisions, as well as some information about some of the highlighted programs that we funded this round. So as Dan said, voters approved the levy in the fall in November, and the program areas that we fund are after-school and mentoring, child abuse intervention and prevention, early childhood programs, and as Dan said, we are funding foster care programs this time around as well. Apologize for that. And as you can see, this was some of the campaign literature that went out in the course of the campaign. After the levy passed, and actually prior to the levy passing, sort of concurrent with, we went out for public input on how to construct our request for investment, which is the sort of funding application that organization will have to fill out to get funding from the Children's Investment Fund. So we sought input from a variety of folks on service needs, on gaps in the system, and on systems issues. We consulted with more than 20 policy groups who work in our funding areas, and also hosted public meetings in three different quadrants of the city. The biggest themes from the input were a need for more services in the eastern part of the city, particularly east of 82nd Avenue, and more need for culturally specific programs. The allocation committee that Dan referred to divided up the funding amongst the different areas that we fund, and this was based on the public input we received, which was recommending that we do roughly a third in each of the major areas, which is early childhood, after school, and mentoring, which is mostly for school-age youth, and child abuse prevention and intervention slash foster care. So those are the precise percentages that were allocated on the screen you see before you. We put out a funding application that allowed organizations to come forward and apply for money, and we had over 100 volunteer grant reviewers come in and help us score those applications. The scores were then forwarded to the allocation committee along with staff recommendations for funding. And the allocation committee made final funding recommendations in a public meeting in which public input was taken before final decisions were made on which organizations to fund. The allocation committee that Dan has referred to and I've referred to a few times is composed of Alyssa Kennegeyer, who's directly to my left, who is the city citizen appointee, Adrian Livingston, who's the county board citizen appointee, if that makes sense, Dan Saltzman, who sits before you, Ted Wheeler, who's the chair of the county commission, and Ron Belts, who is the nominee of the Portland Business Alliance. As Dan said, we received approximately a little more than 2.5 times the funding requested as compared to the funding that we had to give out. So just a sort of a chart to give you a sense of what the difficult choices that were before the committee. And then I'm just going to go briefly through some of the programs that were funded and give you a sense of the types of things that the Children's Investment Fund does. So in early childhood, we funded in this round Albina Head Start, which will provide center-based and home-based early Head Start services for 60 0 to 3-year-olds annually. And that includes early education and parenting support. We also funded Morrison Child and Family Services, which will provide home visiting services to 200 Latino children age 0 to 3, and those services include parent education and child development support, as well as to provide mental health consultation services to 700 to 800 children a year. We funded Neighborhood House, which is located on the west side of Portland, which will provide technical assistance to home-based child care providers, serving 120 children annually, as well as home-based early Head Start services to 55 children annually. We funded Portland Public Schools Head Start program, which provides Head Start preschool and family support services to 83 to 5-year-olds in our community annually. And we funded the Immigrant and Refugee Community Organization, which will provide home visiting and group child development services to 320 Asian, African, Eastern European, and Latino immigrant children and families. In child abuse prevention and intervention, we funded CARES Northwest, which provides urgent medical assessments and appropriate referrals for 230 abused children annually. We funded Lutheran Community Services, which will provide culturally specific family support services for 300 at-risk African and Eastern European immigrant families. I funded the Children's Relief Nursery, which provides therapeutic nursery services, parent education, respite care, mental health services to 400 children who are at risk of abuse and neglect. We funded the Janus Youth Program, which provides alcohol, drug, and mental health treatment services to homeless youth and home visiting services to parent education and violence prevention for 80 teen parents. We funded Volunteers of America to provide relief nursery services, which include therapeutic classrooms, respite care, parent education. Oops, sorry. I missed one. You missed the logos there. Parent education and support and home visiting services to 85 children who are at risk of abuse and neglect annually. In foster care, which again, as Dan said, was a new area of funding, so these are all new programs that were funded. We funded the Native American Youth and Family Center, which provides a variety of culturally specific services that are designed to support family reunification and prevent foster care placement for Native children. And as you may be aware, there's a significant overrepresentation in the foster care system of Native American and African American children. So two of the programs we're highlighting here are programs meant to address that issue. We funded Self Enhancement, Inc., which provides a continuum of services to African American children in foster care that includes school support, case management, after school, summer programming, foster and biological parent support, and transition to independent living for youth who are aging out of the foster care system. We are funded also Impact Northwest, which provides parent child development services for 36 children age 0 to 5 annually who are in foster care. These services include developmental screening, home visits, group activities, and mental health supports for biological parents. And next, we funded Juvenile Rights Project, which provides school support and advocacy services for 230 foster children annually. And we funded, Big Brothers Big Sisters, which provides one-on-one mentoring services for 180 foster children and children who are transitioning out of foster care. Mentoring is a very key service for children who are aging out of the system. Mentoring programs specifically, we funded Friends of the Children that provides community-based mentoring services to 375 children annually and additional supports for adolescent mentees to improve outcomes for high-risk kids. We funded Trillium Family Services, which provides community-based mentoring for 95 children annually. The services are provided by families and by couples and individuals as well, and the mentors are recruited primarily through faith-based institutions. We funded Boys and Girls Aid Society, which provides one-on-one mentoring and academic coaching services for 90 high-risk youth annually. We funded Metropolitan Family Services. Yeah, oops, sorry. I can't, I got a crosswalk between my, don't want to miss and misstate anything. Metropolitan Family Services, which provides one-on-one mentoring, yeah, that'd be great, thanks, tutoring services to 200 children annually through its Experience Corps program. And these are mentors that are, you may have seen some of the articles in the paper and the piece on OPB recently where this program was featured because it engages older adults in helping children. Finally funded in this category, Start Making a Reader Today, which provides mentoring services to 200, reading mentoring services to 200 children annually. And then after school, thank you, okay, we funded Campfire USA, which will provide SUN school services. SUN stands for Schools Uniting Neighborhoods. Services at two David Douglas schools, which did not previously have SUN programming. And SUN provides, this model provides before and after school programs, adult education, and family support and referral services. We funded Open Meadow, which provides, which is an alternative school that provides school-based services to approximately 300 incoming ninth graders and ongoing academic support to 10th graders. These services are designed to be dropout prevention and include intensive tutoring and academic support, parent outreach, enrichment classes, and credit recovery. We funded Ethos Music Center, which provides school-based after-school music programming to 150 children annually. And we funded Northwest Family Services, which provides school-based after-school academic and social supports to 30 Latino youth annually. And finally, Saturday Academy, which provides a variety of school-based after-school enrichment programs to approximately 435 children annually. And a complete listing was included with your packets for all the programs that were funded, but it's too lengthy to go through here. So I'll turn it over to folks who are going to testify.
You're a good, fast reader.
Sorry, I know I talk fast. I try to slow down.
That's a compliment.
Very well done.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Alyssa Kenny-Geyer. I'm on the Allocation Committee. And I know that you've been through a really grueling process. Daily, you go through a grueling process, and particularly in the last 24 hours with the Cesar Chavez and other things on your agenda. And I just wanted to say that this is one of the things that you should feel great about. This is something that Portland does right. We're one of the leaders in the country in it. I'm really proud to be a part of it, and I spend hundreds of hours as a volunteer in it because I so strongly believe in it. And that's for a number of reasons. One is that all of the evidence shows that when you invest in children early on, particularly at-risk children, you increase graduation rates, you decrease their involvement in the judicial system, you increase their ability to be a part of the economic picture, which then sends taxes back to our community. And so we're really putting our public policy and our dollars where the research shows that this is important. Secondly, it is set up with county and city and private input on the allocation committee, and it's one of the things that taxpayers often say, why is it just this division is working with that and that division is working with that, and it's so siloed, and this is one of the places that the city is working with its county and its private partners to come to decisions together, and I think that that kind of coordination on the Children's Investment Fund is really exemplary. Thirdly, we really leverage public dollars when we work by working with nonprofits to meet these needs. Every single one of those nonprofits is run by a board of directors that are all volunteers. Often, many of them incorporate program volunteers, and so we're really leveraging every city dollar when we work with nonprofits in a public-private partnership like this. So I'm proud to be a part of it. I want to thank Commissioner Saltzman for his original vision in articulating Children's Investment Fund and for gaining the support of the City Council, who was wise enough in 2002 and 2008 to pass this on to the voters, and then for the taxpayers to pass it by approximately 51% the first time. It was a new tax, and then overwhelmingly with 70% in a November election right after the market was crashing. So I just think that that really shows the incredible work that Children's Investment has done. I also want to thank the staff because they are really largely responsible for keeping this vision alive, implementing it, monitoring it, keeping their expenses under the mandated 5% administrative cap. They've done a phenomenal job. You've just heard their part in setting up the process, gathering input through community review, interviewing and accepting and training 100 volunteer reviewers to look at these scores. So I want to thank the staff. I want to thank the reviewers and also all the nonprofits. You just saw a long list. Those are only a portion of the ones we funded, and the funders, the ones we funded are only a portion of the ones that applied. So there's a lot of great nonprofits out there that we were not able to fund who put a lot of effort into this, and I thank them all for their work with children in our community. I just wanted to add one thing about the process. Lisa really brought it up to the point where staff was doing the community review, and the point I wanted to highlight was, as an allocation committee member, our process was to receive 128 proposals, along with a summary from the staff of their own perspective and monitoring results of past grantees, as well as theirs and the reviewers' comments on the proposals. And what we ended up receiving was a slate, which the public also got when they walked in the door, with scores on how the proposals rated according to the RFP. That was a starting point, and one of the comments that we made at every single meeting was, it's a starting point. The scores are the scores for the proposals. They're not the score on, we've got to take every single one that's high and just fund it. It's a starting place. It's how the proposal scored according to the RFP requirements, how well it's written. And so it's a double-edged sword, because then often there's an expectation that you're just going to take the higher ones. But it's good that we have that, because it really compels us to say, if we're going to bring one that's lower up, why we need to do that. Or if we're not going to fund one that's higher, it's incumbent on us to say why. So the scores, you know, I was a little reluctant about the scores in the beginning, but I found it very helpful, because it made me articulate why I thought something should be funded or shouldn't be funded, despite a score it might have. One of the places, one of the biases that we were very clear about from the very beginning is that we wanted to continue funding programs that were doing an excellent job in the community and continuing to meet a demonstrated need in the community. And our bias was to go with current grantees who are doing a good job and continuing to meet a need. We also had a strong bias toward opening up some of the new funding, otherwise we wouldn't have gone through a whole new RFP process. We wanted to leave some money for new grantees, and some of the high priority areas for us, as Lisa mentioned, was, number one, was to look at groups that were in serving kids in east of 82nd, because of the demographic shifts where the poverty is really moving east. That was really important to us. It was not something that we were as focused on 6 years ago as we were this time, and it was a correction that needed to be made. Secondly, really looking at culturally specific groups. In so many of these different areas, there is an overrepresentation of communities of color, particularly in the new area of funding, the foster care, where African American and Native Americans are tremendously overrepresented in the foster care system. We had a strong bias based on evidence that shows that culturally specific groups often are in a better position to meet the needs of culturally specific populations. And so we awarded points both for Outer East as well as culturally specific groups. We added points to the process to show that we really did prioritize that. And I think the initial findings of what we ended up funding show that there was a shift in that direction among all of our grantees. The other thing was just making sure that, and this is another thing that we kept trying to stress with people when we had a list of scores, we needed, each of the reviewers were in a group of three or four reviewing three or four proposals, we needed to step back and make sure, do we have a geographic diversity? Do we have a diversity of groups serving African Americans and Latinos and poor whites and a variety of different groups across the city? Do we have a balance between the different kinds of approaches that have been proven to be effective? So that was the job of the allocation committee. Not everyone was, of course, happy with our results, but I've gotten a lot of feedback that they felt that this was very transparent, and whether they agreed or not with our decision, they at least got to see the thinking behind allocation committee members. So I'll close it at that. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer.
Actually, I do have one question.
Commissioner Fritz.
How did you evaluate whether the previously funded programs actually produced real results?
I'm going to partially turn that over to her, but there's a very strong monitoring program, both quarterly reports that are sent in with statistics and then an outside evaluation conducted with PSU. And so I'll let you go into details.
That's enough of an answer.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Hi.
Chantel.
Hi, my name is Chantel Monk, and I'm going to talk about Big Brothers Big Sister and then the benefits of these programs. I got involved in Big Brothers and Big Sisters, I believe, 2005, and I first got my sister. And the reason why I got my sister is because I was placed in foster care along with my other siblings, and they thought that might be helping with the process and make sure that we stay successful young children. And with that in mind, it did actually really work for me. I had someone that I can relate to and someone that was very beneficial for me and helpful if I ever needed her or needed anything. And I also seen a big change in my younger brother, which when we first came to the system, it was really difficult for all of us, but for him, it was too. And I seen like different behavior changes, but when he got his big brother and he started getting involved in sports and everything, his behavior changed. And now he's like in the middle school, but high school's already looking at him for basketball and football. He's also the captain. So these programs really are very successful, and they are good for children, especially ones that are at risk and or ones that are lacking the support in school and at home. But they have someone outside of that that's able to help them and make sure that things are going okay for them and ways to advocate for them if they can't advocate for themselves. And when I look through the list of programs, I actually been involved with quite a few of them. And I'm glad that they're still very successful and that we're going to fund these programs, and I hope everything works out. And I'm also very thankful that we're adding foster care into the investment, because I believe that the system is very, very needs a lot of help and very is not doing as well as it could do, and it needs a lot of funding. I've been in the system 8 years, and I can say that I'm very thankful that I'm almost out just because of the funding and the lack of support that you have in the system. And I'm glad that someone's able to fund the program and looking for ways to help them and ways that things can be improved. And so I'm very thankful for that. I just think that this is good that we're having programs that help the children, because without some of these programs, I don't think I would have did as good as I have done, as soon as I have done. Because I know when I first came to the system, I was lost, and I didn't know what I was going to do. But when these programs came in place and people were helping me, I did a lot better. And I can say that I graduated with a 4.0, and I'm going to Spelman College. Yeah. And I don't think without that and these people, I would have done as good as I'm doing now.
That's awesome. Congratulations.
Thank you, Chantel.
Good work. I have one question for Chantel. You stole my thunder on the first question, which is where you're going to college next year. Mm-hmm. But will you publicly commit to return to Oregon in 4 years?
We will see.
I think she has law school ahead.
Which high school did you graduate from?
De La Salle North Catholic High School.
Nice. Thank you.
And thanks for your service as a Multnomah County Youth Commissioner.
Thank you.
You made a big difference.
No.
Thank you all very much. Really appreciate your testimony. Do we have anyone signed up?
We have one more person. Evelyn L.O. Hart.
Good morning. Welcome to the City Council. We're glad you're here.
Good morning. Thank you.
You just need to give us your first and last name, and you'll have 3 minutes.
Okay. My name is Evelyn Elohart, and I'm the Interim Executive Director of the African Women's Coalition. Mm-hmm. Again, it's the only organization led by immigrant and refugee women from Africa. I'm here this morning because, first, to thank you for the opportunity for us to, as an organization, to apply for the Portland Children Investment Funds. We were among the proposal that had a high score. We had 76, and we came behind big agencies like my mentor agency, Lutheran Community Services. During that process, we felt that we wanted to give a few recommendations not only to the advisory group that work on the proposal, but also to the City of Portland, because it's so important to make sure that it's really an inclusive process, that all the citizens are part of it and understand it, that it's fair during the process that we had the chance to come here and see how they allocated the funds. But when we got here, we were not sure how they're going to do that work. So it was not explained to us. We had an agenda at the door, and we sat here for more than 4 hours to see how they work. For me, at the end, my organization didn't get funded, even if we had a high score. We went and sat down with Lisa. She explained to us how the work was done. At the end of the day for us is, how can we contribute? What can we offer the city to make the process more easy next time? I would have preferred, like today, she did a slideshow to show everybody, even the people at home that watching on TV, how the distribution of the fund were allocated by geographically putting the chart up for the entire city to see that the agency that got funded are not in one location. Have also an economic diversity. What that means by the economic diversity of an agency, that for my community members, all immigrant and refugees, we don't want to see that the city only funded big agencies that have, like, let's say, $500,000 or $1 million in budget. The second thing is to also look at how many organizations that got funded that are run by the people that they serve. For instance, I'm African immigrant. I will have love to see that my organization, with that high profile and a good proposal, we work with African youth, but we didn't get funding. The groups that work for African youth, they got funded, and we're going to try to work with them, but how do you put that in a balance that is even for everybody? And so I'm here today to, again, encourage the city to continue what you have done so far, to engage all the population across the spectrum, and really have big agency, small agency, poor, low-income, minority, everybody come together and really do the best with all our tax dollars. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
All right, unless there's someone else that wishes to testify, that we get to a vote, unless council discussion. And it's an emergency ordinance, so Carla, would you please call the roll?
Fish?
The vote.
First, I want to just acknowledge Commissioner Saltzman's leadership over many years on these issues. Thank him again for the wonderful work he does in our community. To Lisa and Alyssa and Chantel, thank you for an excellent presentation and for all the passion that you bring to this work and your service. And Chantel in particular, I had the great benefit of being the person you were paired with as a Multnomah County Youth Commissioner. Probably you will be a Multnomah County Commissioner someday, but the Youth Commissioner today. And I just want to thank you for all your service to the city, and good luck at Spelman. And I suppose most important to the voters of Portland, who twice have supported this pioneering program, you know, thanks for the continuing confidence in the program. And I think this report gives you even greater reason to feel confident that the money is being spent wisely and prudently. And so I'm very pleased to support the recommendations that have been presented to council. Aye.
Saltzman?
Well, I want to start by thanking, first of all, I think the voters of the city of Portland, who have made this $36 million worth of investments in kids possible, and the jobs associated with helping thousands of kids in the Portland keep those jobs going, creating new jobs also. It's our human infrastructure. So it's a good investment. It's a wise investment. It's one we take very seriously at the Children's Investment Fund. As was mentioned, we do hold our administrative expenses below 5%. I want to thank the 100 or so volunteer reviewers who spent many hours looking over the proposals, the Children's Investment Fund staff for doing a great job under very difficult circumstances, and the work continues. We still have to negotiate the final contracts with each one of these organizations. I want to thank all of the organizations who did apply. Many good programs out there. We just heard from one of them. Many good programs. We were not able to fund all of them. And finally, I want to thank my colleagues on the allocation committee, Alyssa Kinney-Geyer, Ron Belts, Chair Ted Wheeler, and Adrian Livingston. I think this allocation committee really excelled, as have none in the past, in terms of making these decisions. They all did their homework and came to those meetings prepared to do battle, sometimes with each other on the committee. But we did reach consensus recommendations. And then finally, I just want to thank Amy True in my office, who has done a great job of staffing me through this process and done a great job, too. So I'm pleased to vote aye.
Leonard.
One of the benefits of our modern technological world is you can watch the allocation committee on Channel 30, as I do occasionally. And I've always been very impressed with the diligence that each of the allocation committee members bring to the task. And I don't know them all well, but certainly Ted Wheeler and Ron Belts I know well. And I know that they are very results-oriented folks. And so Dan's done a really excellent job in having a very effective allocation committee, which really is ultimately, I think, what makes this program work so well. They focus on the programs that actually help kids and have the best results. And I think the proof has been in the pudding. So I'm really pleased with the program, Dan's leadership, and I'm pleased to vote aye. Aye.
Fritz.
The Children's Investment Fund is a great program that's devoted to our city's children, and the progress reports indicate that these programs are definitely helping our children. I was very glad to hear that we do also have outside evaluation from folks at PSU as part of making sure that that is so. And even the best process can be improved, and thank you for coming in to make some very helpful suggestions from the African Women's Coalition, and I know that Commissioner Saltzman will take that under advisement and look in the next funding rounds. I do note that this is a three-year allocation program, and if the voters were to approve another operating levy, less money than expected would be available for the CHIF, and it's important to be clear how much we can buy under the measure 547 and 50 cap. But this measure, this vote today, does allocate the expected money very, very well. And hopefully we can continue these programs in the future and increase the possibilities for other programs to become a part of this important task, creating stable foundations for our children to build on and create their own productive futures. This was clearly not the year to ask the legislature to expand this program statewide. But I know that in the future, Commissioner Saltzman will agrees that we want to provide these kinds of programs to every child in every county in Oregon, and I'm certainly committed to working with him when the economy recovers to tell the story of what a great job the Children's Investment Fund has done in Portland so that we can encourage other counties and the entire state to fund these programs. Thank you, Commissioner Saltzman, for your leadership on this. Aye.
Adams?
Well, I've had the opportunity to work in this building from the inception of your idea for this, and we wouldn't be here today considering this without your efforts, but it's worth detailing that you had to overcome some institutional pushback, some local government partnership pushback. You've had to raise hundreds of thousands of dollars, get it campaigning, get it passed by voters twice. You did it with the requirements of, rigorous expectations about accountability and results, and you've changed the lives of tens of thousands of our youth in the process. So I just want to laud you for your leadership and your persistence on this, and I couldn't be happier to vote aye. Amy, thank you. Approved.
Wait a second.
Oh, I vote.
Unapproved.
Is there an amendment?
Okay, we have to vote on. I didn't know anything about this amendment. No.
Do you want an amendment?
We need an amendment. Okay.
Do you need to amend this?
Let me show it to the city attorney.
You probably have amended it by now. We could probably have amended it by now if you
so
want.
So moved. Why don't we just go ahead and go through the process of, rather than having us kind of.
So we need to vote to reconsider?
Yes.
So I make a motion to reconsider?
Second. Yeah.
It's been moved and seconded. Any discussion? Anyone wishes to testify? Carla, would you please call the vote on reconsideration of Council Calendar Item 892?
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. We're in reconsideration. Do I hear a motion to amend?
So moved.
It's been moved and seconded to amend. What are we amending, just so we have it?
Amending as per the memo that was passed out to the council June 22nd, 2009.
Clarifying the intent, not changing the intent. Any discussion on the amendment? Carla, would you please call the roll on the amendment?
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. Amendment is approved. Unless there's additional council discussion, let's vote on the main motion.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. So approved. I believe that gets us to council calendar item 893, which is a resolution. Carla, can you please read the title?
Pursue negotiations with Peregrine LLC regarding a financing plan for a major league soccer stadium separately from negotiations regarding a financing plan for construction of a AAA baseball stadium.
Commissioner Leonard.
So maybe we could have Greg Pete and Don Maggi to come forward only to prepare. I think Mayor Adams would like each member of the council to have an opportunity to say something before they say anything. Former Mayor Katz. You're coming forward, Mira?
Yeah.
Well, why don't you? Come on. We want you. Well, she still doesn't listen to anything I say. So.
Why start now?
Yeah. There's probably a book in here somewhere of the last few months figure out not only how to bring Major League Soccer to Portland, but how to also simultaneously keep the Portland Beavers in Portland. Unfortunately, the book's not ready to be written because it's not over yet. And if I've learned anything from this issue, it's not over till it's over. But having said that, I've really never been involved in an issue that has been more fascinating because of the highs and even because of the lows. It has been truly the singular most instructive sets of processes I've ever been involved in, and I checked with Vera to ask her about her experience, and she agreed that even for her, this was unique in the world of politics. But it is so because it is such an important issue. So many people argue this issue from the point of view of dollars and cents, and I think that misses the point. You can't argue public education from the point of view of dollars and cents. You can't argue community colleges or universities from the standpoint of dollars and cents. It provides each of those issues, whether it's a community college or whether it's a university or whether it's bringing a professional level sport to our city, provides a quality of life that makes Portland more livable. There are many Fortune 500 companies when searching out places to locate, want to know what is available for their employees to recreate. It is very important that there are teams like the Blazers. It is very important that we have baseball. It is very important that we have professional soccer. It provides another venue for a quality of life that each of us has as an aspect of our being. We work, we make money, we have obligations, but we also have a tremendous need to have outlets. And for many, many Portlanders, that outlet is soccer. And if you don't think that that's true, one need only go to a Timbers game, as I have, and watch the Timbers Army. That is a really inspirational experience all by itself in addition to the team. So I appreciate, Mayor Adams, your partnership with me throughout this. We have worked, we have always worked closer together, but we've worked closer in the last few months on this, and I've really appreciated your thoughtfulness and your creativity and your perseverance on this issue. We wouldn't be here today, I know, without your leadership on this. I mean, I can believe strong in this. Others can believe strong in it, but it requires a mayor that that takes a leadership on any of these issues for things like this to happen. So having said that, I turn this over to you, Mayor Adams.
Thank you. Well, I want to thank you, Commissioner Leonard, for your passion and your creativity and your perseverance. This has been, and these kinds of issues are always controversial. This one more so than most. We have followed the little bit of sort of review of history to sort of get everyone caught up to date, connect some dots, put together some of the separate storylines. When the task force issued its recommendation, it asked us to look first at the Rose Quarter and then at Lentz. When it became clear after the design charrette that to place AAA for AAA baseball stadium, when it became clear after the design charrette that we would have to take down Memorial Coliseum in order to put in a baseball AAA baseball stadium, even a odd-sized AAA baseball stadium in the Rose Quarter, we began looking at Lentz. We've looked at Lentz. Commissioner Leonard has tried as hard as anyone on that score, but we don't have adequate public support for that site either. So today, this resolution delinks the issues, allows us to move forward with pursuing the opportunity of Major League Soccer at PGE Park. That's what today's resolution is all about, and I wholeheartedly support it as a co-sponsor. Who would like to go first?
Mayor Adams, Commissioners Greg Peden on behalf of the Paulson family, good morning. Thank you, Commissioner Leonard and Mayor Adams, on behalf of the City Council and the city on all of the efforts to date. I think you gave a pretty good history of things, so I won't belabor it. The resolution before you today is to do exactly what the mayor just said, decouple the two issues. In the immediate future here, we're going to push real hard on the soccer deal. We have a September 1 looming deadline. Don's going to talk in a moment about some of the criteria for that deadline. We are going to continue the search for the proper location for the Beavers. But for today, we kind of wanted to get the focus back on soccer. With that in mind, what I've brought along here is just a very quick video to just sort of refresh all of our memories of what we're talking about here with Major League Soccer and the opportunity that's before us as a community. What I'm going to show you is ran on Channel 8 Monday night. Maybe some of you have seen it. It's just a real quick clip on what's going on in Seattle, which is the newest edition of MLS and the success that they're having with the team and the community spirit they have. And I don't need to remind you that they, in a minor league scenario, we're our number one rival, and in a major league scenario, we'll be our number one rival as well. And that's going to be referenced here. So if, with your permission, I'm going to hit play and show you this quick clip. Maybe not.
Carla,
can you? I had a feeling that might happen.
And Major League Soccer, an overwhelming success in Seattle. Can Portland expect the same reaction when Joe Becker found out on a trip to the Emerald City? Portland's working hard to bring Major League Soccer to the city for 2011. As the Timbers and their fans make their push, we have both a great role model and a tough act to follow. Joe Becker traveled north to Seattle, where MLS is already the city's hottest ticket.
Tunes from a marching band, national TV cameras, and a packed house at Quest Field. It's a perfect recipe for football, even if we call it soccer.
I have Seahawks season tickets. Sounders is a lot better.
I've been to Seahawks games, too. This is by far and away the best sporting event I've been to.
Number one in the world!
The World's Game has taken over in Seattle, and the fans have taken notice.
When do you start getting amped for the games?
want to wake up. Want to wake up, honestly. Yeah. And I've been up since 4 today, so I've been looking forward to this all day long.
The Sounders lead Major League Soccer in attendance, with ticket sales allowing the team to expand seating at Quest Field several times. Before the season, the plan was to have 24,000 seats. They sold so well, they upped it to 27+. They've sold out every single game. Now they're up to 32,000 with their next game, and they're still sold out.
We knew the fans would support us, but, it 30,000 a game, sold out, not a ticket to be had. It's a little bit beyond our, I guess, most of our reasonable dreams.
Adrian Hanauer has been a Sounders owner since 2001. He's made the same jump Merritt Paulson and the Timbers will make in 2011. He's more than happy to offer advice.
Merritt and I talk quite often. Merritt's a smart guy. He's motivated. It's the right city. It's the right time. I have no doubts that it'll be hugely successful in Portland.
And the fans are looking forward to hitting the pitch against the Timbers.
So the Timbers going to beat you guys on a regular basis?
No. Never happened.
Just I-5 more up all over again.
I think there'll be busloads going back and forth, and I'm sure on the pitch it'll carry over, and it'll be amazing.
Well, the Sounders and Timbers renew their rivalry, temporarily anyway, July 1st. That game is at PGE Park for the U.S. Open Cup tournament.
Okay, thank you for indulging us. Just as a reference that Joe Donlin just mentioned, next week's July 1, next Wednesday night, the Sounders are coming down for an exhibition game against the Timbers. If you have nothing else to do that evening, we'd love to see you there and get a sense of exactly what we're talking about. So I think with that, I'll turn it over to Don.
Thank you. Don Mazziotti. I'm consulting development executive for Peregrine Sports. I've asked Carla to hand out to you a 2-page document called Master Design and Construction Schedule. I provide this to you really just to kind of give you a sense of what has to happen between now and September 1st, which is the drop-dead date for MLS soccer. The red line that runs through on the left-hand side of 2009, basically the end of June or where we are approaching today, gives you a sense of how much there is to accomplish, as Commissioner Leonard has suggested, between now and then. And I'm very hopeful that starting with today and your action today that we can get moving expeditiously because, frankly, my job depends upon it. If I'm unable to bring these things to accomplishment, there's no reason for me to continue. I am satisfied that these things can be accomplished, especially with the help of the Bureau of Development Services and others, the council itself. And so we have about 14 steps that need to be taken between now and September 1, and I believe the issue before you today is the first of those steps. Thank you.
One aspect of the renovations to PG Park that has not gotten, a lot of media time, nor have we talked much about it, and that's the co-location of the Vikings, and that this will give them the opportunity to potentially move up in the quality of their division in football. Could you sketch out a little more detail to that?
Well, the requirement for the Vikings to play at the highest level of intercollegiate football NCAA rules is to have 23,000 seats in place for games at a minimum. The plans that we have in place and that we're working on, although they're not, we haven't even begun schematic design, is the intention to add 10,000 seats to the existing 19,980 seats, to take some subset of that number away simply because they're old wooden seats that go back to 1926 in some cases. We will, incidentally, refinish all of that wood and reclaim it and use it throughout the park for other applications. But it does mean a major step up for the Vikings. It means that they'll have a venue to play in that will allow them to play at the highest level, which some would argue is, a kickstart for the university involved in terms of fundraising and identification and all of the rest around the country. Certainly they have the academic qualities. I think the athletic qualities would follow, would be assisted by this development. I should also mention, Mr. Mayor, that there are 72 baseball games played. There are 9 football games, standard American football games played. There may be 15 exhibition games, up to 5 concerts under the Good Neighbor Agreement. All the rest of those days are booked for community events, 250 days of use by this facility for things other than commercial activities, most of which are for high schools, junior high schools, Girl Scouts, and other sorts of community and cultural events.
Other discussion from council?
I have some questions. I don't know whether this is the right panel. Is this our only panel?